January as part of a move to reincorporate and relocate from New York to Texas.
Oh, good luck with that, NRA. Too soon to talk about it?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Thoughts and prayers, guys.
I got the feeling that something is I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, in Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me, and I swear to it, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Luckily, there has not been any mass shootings in the U.S., at least that I know of. Not huge ones. It's getting harder and harder to keep track, but not any that I know of since the weekend. When there was a shooting in a Wisconsin casino, but you know what? That was a day or three ago, so is now the right time to talk about gun violence and what can be done about it? And whether or not one of the biggest supporters and facilitators of gun violence in this country, that would be the National Rifle Association, will even be able to survive themselves much longer to keep doing so. After an absolutely stunning moment in their ongoing federal bankruptcy trial in a Texas courtroom this week, the wildly corrupt NRA is desperately trying to evade a lawsuit by the New York State Attorney General, who hopes to dissolve them entirely. Will they be able to pull it off? Well, it has been kind of an insane court case, receiving surprisingly little coverage, frankly, by the corporate media. So we will do something about that momentarily with the author of a book about how to defeat the NRA, which, by the way, is almost looking like it's a done deal at this point, Des.
Yeah, some of the stuff that has been going on in that bankruptcy court down in Texas is shocking.
It is. You would think that.
I mean, even for the NRA.
You would think that would be, you know, kind of bigger news these days. But anyway, Igor Volsky of Guns Down America will join us shortly to discuss that amazing trial and how and if America can move forward with new gun safety laws, whether the NRA still exists or not. And yes, they may about to be getting a big helping hand from the Republicans' stolen and packed U.S. Supreme Court, but we'll talk about all of that with Igor in just a few minutes. But speaking of not getting enough coverage from the corporate media, it seems like it was just a week or two ago that the media were on and on and on about a so-called crisis at the border, Biden's border crisis, with children locked up in cages that put to shame anything the Trump administration had ever done, because apparently the Biden administration was so unprepared about what would happen as soon as they took office and announced they would no longer be simply sending children back over the border without parents, wishing them the best of luck or whatever the Trump administration was doing. Well, you know, the media was on and on about that for the last month or three, it seems like. And you would be forgiven if you had not heard about this side of the story, since, of course, Fox News isn't going to be plastering it all over the place, which generally means the rest of the corporate media will not either. In fact, it wasn't until Tuesday morning, it seems, before Washington Post bothered to mention this at all. Here's their brief coverage of what seems to me, at least, to be very a big story and, frankly, very encouraging news. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the Biden administration has, quote, drastically reduced the number of unaccompanied migrant children and teens in border jails from, get this, 5,767 on March 28 to just under 600 on Tuesday. That would be a nearly 90% drop, the paper notes. The Biden administration expanded Health and Human Services emergency shelters over the past month to care for the children, opening up 14 emergency shelters in a matter of weeks instead of leaving them, these kids, for days in Border Patrol jails after they cross into the U.S. from Mexico. They are the kids, by the way, are only allowed to stay in those facilities under federal law for 72 hours before they have to be either reunited with a parent or a guardian or moved to a facility especially meant to care for minors until they can be placed with relatives in or in foster homes, etc. More than 22,200 minors were in HHS custody on Sunday, according to the most recent tally available, according to the Post, in their tiny little eight-paragraph story at the very bottom of this long list of items in their live updates blog that was published on Tuesday. Officials have said the administration is trying to reunite them with their parents or guardians in the U.S. as soon as possible, but Mayorkas told the Washington Conference on the Americas that they were far better off in shelters than in the Border Patrol jails. He said the number of minors in border jails is falling, quote, because we have a plan, and we have always had a plan, he said. Our plans take time to execute, but we know how to do it, and we do the hard work. He said the challenge is not behind us, but we have made extraordinary achievements in 30 days. I should say so, going from about 6,000 kids in these facilities down to under 600. In just a month. Mayorkas said that minors are now spending far less time in the border jails, about 30 hours, compared with several days in late March. Remember, the law that the Trump administration pretty much completely ignored or didn't even bother to try and comply with requires minors to be held in those, yes, cages for no more than 72 hours. HHS officials say more than 80% of the children and teens have a parent or relative in the U.S. Most are from Central America. The Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas said the Border Patrol has, quote, performed heroically by caring for children in the jails before they can be transferred to HHS. They know better than anyone that a Border Patrol facility is no place for a child, he said. And that's it for Washington Post coverage. But that's good. That's very good news.
That's surprising. And I didn't know about it until you told me about it.
Well, yeah, very little. And it's you know, quite the turnaround from just a couple of weeks ago when they were all yelling, you know, sure, Fox News, but also CNN, also, yes, Washington Post. You know, that they were all running sort of around the clock, crisis at the border, kids in cages, even worse under Biden than Trump and all of that. So that all gets sort of cleared up in short order as the new administration gets stood up and media don't care. No big story here. Now, prior to this short squib in the Post, if you were lucky enough to find it at all, frankly, on Tuesday, our friend and media critic Eric Bollert noted in his press run newsletter, 1 month after falsely blaming the Biden administration for creating a crisis at the southern border, the Washington Post remains oddly reserved regarding good news about the plummeting number of migrant youths now held in U.S. detention centers. And again, this was on Monday. This was before the Post had even done that little short story. Bullard notes the Post for months had led the media charge with nonstop negative coverage about the surge, coverage that often mimics GOP talking points. The surge he's referring to here is the annual surge of immigrants at the southern border that happens pretty much every year right around this time when the weather begins to warm up. But now, he writes, as conditions at the border improve, much of the media, including the Post, are suddenly less interested in the immigration story.
Go figure. What's that about?
The good news came first, he says, last Thursday when CNN published a scoop detailing how the number of unaccompanied children held by U.S. Customs and Border Protection had, quote, dropped nearly 84% in the span of a month, underscoring the significant progress made by the administration after reaching record high custody figures. The decline, they reported, was mostly because the Department of Health and Human Services has opened up a string of temporary shelters to accommodate the minors. The New York Times soon confirmed the drop over the past month in the number of migrant children in Border Patrol custody on Sunday night. However, a check of Google and of the Post's own archives uncovered no standalone reports in any recent days regarding detentions at the border or any dispatches quoting Mayorkas about the extreme decline in these numbers. And yet he goes back to March when the Post had considered the number of unaccompanied migrant teens and children in detention to be a huge deal. In fact, they reflected, quote, the magnitude of the crisis that Biden faced. He goes through some of the day after day sort of what he calls doomsday headlines that were echoing the conservative talking points that were run by The Washington Post. Headlines like Biden administration rushes to accommodate border surge with few signs of plans to contain it. Biden officials fall behind in race to add more shelter space for migrant teens and children. Biden faces growing political threat from border upheaval. No end in sight inside the Biden administration's failure to contain the border surge. At the border, a widely predicted crisis that caught Biden off guard. That final headline, he notes, was published just days ago, meaning the Post was still pushing the bogus narrative that that Biden had bungled the border and created this crisis, even after other media outlets were saying, it's kind of fixed now. 5 weeks ago, he says, the Post uncorked a finger-pointing front-page piece designed to portray the White House as standing on the brink of a defining and fatal failure. The piece stressed the issue of immigration. It could be a loser for Democrats. It could cost them the House in 2022 and even, quote, overshadow the administration's successes in vaccinating tens of millions of Americans in recent weeks. The paper's GOP-friendly report also included no context for how Biden's new administration had been addressing border crossings while at the same time dealing with the aftermath of a deadly insurrection, an impeachment trial, rolling out an unprecedented nationwide vaccination regime, and passing the largest social spending bill in U.S. history by a single vote in the Senate. Not to mention, I would add, rebuilding an immigration intake program that had been absolutely decimated, gutted by the previous administration. And since dealing with children is the work of Health and Human Services, HHS, you know, it should be noted that HHS had sort of moved all hands on deck in support of Biden's massive vaccine rollout and distribution program. That kind of took priority when Biden first came in office. Bullard notes if the administration were to blame for the migrant crisis, if its missteps were the reason for the rising number of border detentions, as the Post insisted in March, doesn't it stand that the Biden administration deserves credit for the sweeping reduction at the border that is now unfolding? Or does the Post only consider bad news for the White House to be real news? The Post literally ran a border detention story that included this quote in the headline. Quote, no end in sight.
Except for that end.
Except
that was
for the
inside
end.
Right there in front of
right.
them.
Right, yeah. So that's where we are. The paper has, he says, has hardly been alone in echoing the apocalyptic GOP rhetoric about the border in a highly unusual move. He says ABC This Week in late March staged its entire Sunday program from the border in order to focus on the, quote, emerging crisis for the Biden administration. And then he also notes that, remember his press conference, Biden's big, they made a big deal. It's his inaugural press conference. It's taken longer than anybody has ever taken to have a
press conference.
A press conference, right. Well, he was peppered with questions about the border, which the GOP was pushing, but he did not get a single question at the time about COVID-19, a topic that the GOP was not pushing.
Mm.
So, you know, I should note that a lot of good stuff that the administration has done to date is thanks to the fact that both media and, as often, maybe even more often, the progressives and the Progressive Caucus in Congress have been pushing him to go farther on many of those policies than he might normally do on his own. So there is a place for the press here, of course. For example, Biden was shamefully slow in lifting Trump's cap on incoming refugees, people who had already been approved to come to the U.S., but who the Trump administration had arbitrarily stopped from doing so just to keep them out by putting a record low cap of like 15,000 would be allowed for the entire fiscal year to come in. Refugees who had already been screened and approved and were just being kept out because Trump's a jerk. So all the new president needed to do was sign an executive order to raise that cap to allow those folks who had been waiting for months and even years to come in. But Biden apparently was worried about the optics. And given our media, I guess I can sort of kind of understand where he was coming from in that regard. But it was intolerably inhumane. And it took until this Monday and a lot of complaints from human rights and immigration advocates and fellow Democrats and progressives and, yes, media pointing it out before Biden on Monday finally lifted the annual limit on the number of refugees who will be admitted to the U.S. through September, the end of the fiscal year, from the record low cap of 15,000 set by the previous administration, now to 62,500. So that's good. So I'm not saying he should not be pressed, but, you know, for crying out loud, as Bullard says, the press and GOP helped create this so-called border crisis this year. So they should acknowledge the reality when that crisis changes. Biden said in a statement, by the way, that the Trump administration's policy on refugee caps, quote, did not reflect America's values as a nation that welcomes and supports refugees. And he also reinforced his goal. This is just this week of 125,000 for the refugee cap for the next fiscal year beginning in October, but said it will still be hard to hit, because that's thanks to rebuilding the entire system from scratch that Donald Trump had dismantled. So, you know, I'm not against criticizing the guy as appropriate, but using GOP talking points against him and then not bothering to report when those talking points fall apart, that is just journalistic malpractice that needs to be called out. So I thought I should do so. As to fiscal malpractice, actually out and out fraud, at least when it comes to running a 150-year-old charitable organization, well, that's where we turn next, as the indescribably corrupt liars and leaders of the NRA may finally be in their death throes after years of misusing member funds for their personal use and even enjoying millions of dollars worth of secret employment contracts that they drew up for themselves from the very vendors with whom they worked. Nice work if you can get it. But it looks like that party may be just about over after some astounding new revelations in a federal courtroom in Texas this week. That story is next on the broadcast with non-corrupt NRA expert Igor Volsky. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Beneath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Yeah, well, the NRA may not be able to get that nice work anymore after what's going on this week. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We continue to endure mass shootings and nonstop gun violence in this country. Of late, there has been another spate of mass shootings, which get most of the limelight and media attention, including at two different spas in Atlanta in late March, a grocery store in Boulder, Colorado, days later, at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis a week or so after that, a casino near Green Bay, Wisconsin over this past weekend. That one, by the way, with fairly little press coverage, perhaps because only, in quotes, only two were killed, or perhaps because, like all of the others, it's just one more in a seemingly endless wave of gun violence that we have become all too used to and all too numb to in this country, as our political system appears so helplessly broken that it seems the wishes of the vast majority of the American people to see lawmakers take action to at least try and curb the violence, the endless bloodbath, it seems like it's all but fruitless, even when it comes to taking action on the lowest hanging fruit, like closing loopholes in our background check systems or instituting national red flag laws that would allow law enforcement or family members to seek an order from a court to take away the weapons from someone believed to be a danger to him or herself or to others. Closing background check loopholes are something that even some 90% of NRA members agree on, even if the terror-loving organization's corrupt leadership does not. But our political system on this matter isn't just broken, at least in my opinion. It has been purposely crippled by decades of dangerously dishonest leadership by the NRA and false advocacy against any and all gun safety laws based on a purposely disingenuous reading of the Constitution's Second Amendment, which, by the way, reads in full because the NRA does not like you hearing the entire amendment. Even though it's just one single sentence, it reads in full, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They like to leave off the well-regulated part at the very least, truncating that single sentence most often to the misleading, quote, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Never mind all that pesky, unconstitutional regulation mentioned specifically in the constitutional amendment itself. Here's conservative, then former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Warren Burger discussing this very point in 1991.
If I were writing the Bill of Rights now, there wouldn't be any such thing as the Second Amendment.
Which says?
That a well-regulated militia being necessary for the defense of the state, the people's rights to bear arms. This has been the subject of one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime.
Well, there you go. That's how much things have changed since 1991. The conservative Chief Justice of the Supreme Court calling special interests, we know who he's talking about there, and their interpretation of the Second Amendment as a fraud. But the confusion on all of this is thanks in no small part to decades of lies by the National Rifle Association, founded as a nonprofit charitable gun enthusiast and safety organization in New York State in 1871, until it was taken over and weaponized, if you will, by the gun manufacturing industry in a leadership coup in the 1970s that has turned it into what it is today. And what it is today, according to New York State Attorney General Letitia James, among other things, is a corrupt organization, so, quote, fraught with fraud and abuse, as the state's complaint to shut down the organization, filed last August, explained, that it must simply be dissolved entirely at this point. Some of that fraud and abuse includes its longtime chief, Wayne LaPierre, using the nonprofit charitable organization's money to buy hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of suits for his personal use from a fancy Beverly Hills boutique, private air charters at least 8 times in a 3-year period to the Bahamas at a cost of more than $500,000, where he and his family were gifted the use of a 107-foot yacht owned by an NRA vendor. Millions of dollars in unwarranted travel around the world, spending more than $3.6 million in the last 2 years alone on travel consultants and luxury car services. The Attorney General's list goes on and on in her lawsuit to shut down the NRA, but as the NRA does, they are fighting back by cutting and running, essentially. LaPierre, without consulting the NRA board or even its general counsel, according to the Washington Post, declared the organization would declare bankruptcy, seeking legal court protection before reconstituting itself in the state of Texas, which apparently is happy to welcome corrupt, phony charitable organizations with open arms. It's a state, after all, with an attorney general who has been indicted on securities fraud felonies himself. He is facing those charges now as he is being investigated by the FBI. So, yeah, not big on rule of law stuff down there in the Lone Star State. But the state of New York isn't having it, and they're challenging the federal bankruptcy declaration as a ruse to avoid accountability. And news from a federal courtroom in Texas on Monday would seem to back up New York's argument. A U.S. Justice Department official all but quashed the NRA's hopes at declaring bankruptcy and moving to Texas on Monday. The U.S. trustee, a DOJ office that enforces bankruptcy laws and which rarely takes sides in bankruptcy disputes, told a Texas federal judge that it opposed the NRA bankruptcy petition and that, quote, the evidentiary record clearly and convincingly establishes that NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre, quote, failed to provide the proper oversight. The record is unrefuted that Wayne LaPierre's personal expenses were made to look like business expenses, Assistant U.S. Trustee Lisa Lambert told federal bankruptcy judge Harlan Hale this week, according to the New York Times. It's an extremely rare rebuke from the office of the U.S. trustee, and it comes as the NRA tries to use Chapter 11 bankruptcy to reconstitute itself in the gun-friendly state of Texas. The trustee's remarks reportedly stunned the NRA's attorney in the case. So what does that mean for the NRA's bid to escape New York's lawsuit and accountability for the looting of its own organization? Is this now the death rattle for the NRA officially? And do its members, who have been played for suckers for years by cretins like LaPierre, even care? Especially as the U.S. Supreme Court announced last week they have decided to hear a challenge filed by the NRA to a New York law that prevents gun owners from taking their weapons outside of their homes without a permit, for which they need to explain a cause for carrying that weapon outside. And, of course, what does the potential downfall of the 150-year charitable organization mean to the ongoing obstruction of gun safety laws by so many, usually Republican lawmakers, armed with NRA backing and cash? Joining us now for some insight into some of those questions and maybe more as we take a moment to keep up with the terrorist-loving NRA in its hopefully death throes is our old friend Igor Volsky, who is now the founder of GunsDownAmerica.org, dedicated to building a future with fewer guns. Here's an idea. His new book is Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns, including ideas for solving our national gun epidemic. Well, good luck with that. Hey, it's been a long time, sir, but welcome back to the broadcast, Igor Volsky.
Brad, very good to be with you.
I tried to catch up with a whole bunch of stuff there at once in that intro. Thank you for tolerating it, because we put a premium on accuracy here and yes, fairness on this show. So I want to make sure, have I overstated, understated, misrepresented, incorrectly explained anything in my sort of attempt to, you know, bring all of these ideas together in what sure seems to me to be the death rattles of the NRA that your book hopes to defeat?
Well, Brad, you did a great job, and if anything, you understated the kind of revelations we heard from the bankruptcy trial that has been ongoing for the last 10 days or so, mm-hmm. in which Wayne LaPierre, NRA board members, and other top NRA officials admitted to many of the just jaw-dropping allegations that were made against it by the New York Attorney General back in August. And just to underscore one admission that really stunned the courtroom, mm-hmm. was the current NRA CEO, the current NRA president, mm-hmm. admitting that she shred and burnt documents because she feared that they could be used against the organization. You know, nothing, in my view, is crazier than that. But here we are in court, in open court, and that kind of admission is made. You know, how innocent people behave.
I assume that's a crime, is it not, to shred documents like that? Isn't she going into bankruptcy court here and essentially admitting to a crime that could also now be brought against her by the New York Attorney General?
Well, the great fear, according to insiders, that at least Wayne LaPierre has, mm-hmm. is that the next wave of charges are going to be criminal and that he's going to find himself in an orange jumpsuit. In fact, he told colleagues at the NRA that he needed to hire this one particular law firm to whom the NRA has paid somewhere to the tune of $50 to $60 million to try and keep him and the organization, but mostly him, out of jail.
Wow. So what in this particular case, in the bankruptcy case, what does it mean that the U.S. trustee, as I'm reading it, U.S. trustees very rarely do this. They tend to go along with bankruptcy plans, I guess, when they are presented. So what is the trustee coming out on Monday to reject NRA's bankruptcy here, as I read it, essentially declaring it's not legitimate, but just meant to avoid accountability? What's that actually mean now to the group and their attempts to, well, do exactly that?
Well, look, let's back up a bit and remember that when the Attorney General of New York filed this lawsuit back in August of 2020, mm-hmm. she revealed, as I've mentioned, just a whole list of abuses at the hands of Wayne LaPierre and his top lieutenants. The NRA responded to that lawsuit in two different ways. The first is they sued the Attorney General, claiming that she was just going out against them because they had different politics, mm-hmm. that she was on some kind of, you know, political quest mm-hmm. to squash the NRA. That's number one. And number two is that they filed for bankruptcy. Now, what was revealed during the bankruptcy trial is that Wayne LaPierre did this without ever informing the board,
yes.
of the NRA or top NRA officials. In fact, only three other people knew that he intended to do that.
The general counsel, as I understand it, was not even informed that he was going to declare bankruptcy.
Yeah, that's right. And they also took a very unusual approach for an organization that claims they can no longer pay their bills. They publicly said that they are as strong as they've ever been, that They are is still the nation's premier gun rights organization, but that they were simply using this maneuver in order to get outside of the New York Attorney General's jurisdiction and move to Texas, where, as you point out, the laws are a lot weaker. That's not how one uses bankruptcy, and that's also not the way bankruptcy law works. And so by the time they got into this trial, what ended up happening is that their revelations and their own testimony simply underscored the allegations made by the Attorney General, which were that the organization was completely mismanaged and was being used as a piggy bank for LaPierre and his friends. And you're right, the fact that that Justice Department official, in a kind of a last-minute move as closing arguments were happening, said that she does not believe that this bankruptcy was made in good faith and that it was simply a way to avoid their legal problems, avoid angry vendors who are demanding to be paid. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, strongly asked the judge to dismiss this bankruptcy motion. The judge, my understanding, has a lot of latitude in these kinds of cases, so we'll see which way he goes. But it's certainly, you know, as you know, stunned the NRA lawyer and probably stunned the NRA.
Yeah. And by the way, you say this is not how one is supposed to use bankruptcy laws. It's not, but a lot of people do, I think, use it that way. The fact that they are actually admitting as much, however, is kind of astounding, that they're saying it out loud. Oh, we're actually fine. We don't need bankruptcy here. We're just doing it to avoid New York.
You know, Brad, if I may, there's just so many shocking pieces about this entire case that, you know, you don't even know where to begin.
Yep.
The fact that you had multiple high-level NRA leaders leave the organization and then secure multi-thousand monthly consulting contracts. One was for $30,000 a month to do literally nothing because they never actually did any work for any of the quote-unquote consulting that they did. The fact that Wayne LaPierre was able to secure an employment contract that I think was later retracted, but at the time he pushed it through without board consent, that would have given him, get this, $17 million even after he left the NRA is just stunning. The fact that Wayne LaPierre's personal secretary diverted $40,000 from NRA funds to pay for her son's wedding and is still employed by the NRA is simply unbelievable. The fact that even after the Attorney General filed her lawsuit in August, the NRA was still flying Wayne LaPierre and board executives on first-class flights, even though that violated NRA policy, is just another sign that they don't think any rules or laws apply to them.
Wow, unbelievable. Igor Volsky, you mentioned the vendors are ticked off because I guess in bankruptcy proceedings, everything sort of stops as far as payments and so forth to vendors. But do we have any sense of how the members, how this petition to dissolve the organization itself has affected membership and donations and so forth at this point? Has any of it hurt them, or their followers generally kept so deep into the right-wing fake news bubble that they don't even realize any of this stuff is going on at this point?
Well, so we do know that membership dues dropped, at least over the last couple of years, that they've seen a dip. That they've also seen a dip in some other revenue streams as well, and that their membership number is about at 4.8 million, which also appears to be a decline. And as you know, publicly, they talk about 5 or 6 million members. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they had to admit a lower number, I'm assuming, is somewhat embarrassing for them. But look, the hardcore members who are the politicized gun owners, it's not going to matter. You know, what kind of news comes out, it's not going to matter that around this time, video from I think 3 or 4 years ago was unearthed of Wayne LaPierre and his wife shooting and killing an elephant. The fact that embarrassment is probably not going to matter, because the way the NRA operates, which is the same way the Republican Party now operates, is through a kind of a total control system. You're either with us fully or you're against us. There's no in between. So you can't criticize Mr. LaPierre for his leadership of the organization, because if you do, you're deemed anti-gun and you're pushed out.
So these people are happy to give their money to, you know, corrupt clowns like LaPierre, who wasted on all sorts of crap and nonsense that actually has nothing to do with what they think they are supporting. But hey, it's all, they're on our team, so I guess it's okay. On Monday, you know, after the U.S. trustee announced the opposition to the bankruptcy, New York State's attorney called the gun lobby's attempted move, quote, a circus sideshow designed to avoid legal accountability. This, according to The Washington Post, warning that approving its reorganization plan would risk turning bankruptcy courts into, quote, a haven for wrongdoers. Well, yeah, that's why the NRA is there. Anyway, the NRA lawyer countered that the bankruptcy plan was vital to its survival and the future success of what he termed, quote, an irreplaceable civil rights organization, arguing, quote, there is no one who stands in the breach to defend the Second Amendment other than the NRA. Well, okay, really? Are they that integral to the modern gun movement and the dishonest representation of the Second Amendment, Igor?
Well, look, they're certainly the biggest and loudest voices in the room. But the reality is that there are a number of other organizations that do similar messaging, similar campaigns, similar kind of content. And I suspect that those organizations are now thinking about, well, how do we use this as an opportunity to grow our membership lists and pull numbers from the NRA?
Yeah, and it also seems to me not only are there all of these other groups, but I'm not sure that anything, well, other than jail for Wayne LaPierre, but, you know, that anything keeps them from, you know, just setting up a completely new and totally different organization in Texas called, you know, the American Rifle Association, or maybe the National Assault Rifle Association. In other words, it feels like the NRA might die, but their dishonest movement, it seems to me, will not. Am I too cynical here, Igor?
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's because, as you know, Brad, the NRA and other gun voices have really been able to form an entire identity around gun ownership. That the gun is more than just a tool. It is something that makes you American. It is something that makes you patriotic. It is something that gives you meaning and value. And any efforts to try and limit gun availability is an affront not just to some policy issue, but to you as an individual and as an American. And that's the power, frankly, of the kind of pull the NRA and other similar voices have. So even if they go away and Wayne goes to jail and whatever else happens, the central challenge that we're going to have is how do you look out at the millions of Americans who have bought this message since about 1911, by the way, is the first time the NRA had its members speak out against a New York gun law, by the way, the very same law that's now being challenged in front of the Supreme Court, in the same kind of rhetoric that they use today. So it's a message they've been hearing for decades and decades and decades, and how you permeate that, that's the central challenge of this issue.
Since you raised the issue of the case at the Supreme Court, there are still some laws at the books at the state level when it comes to guns. We'll talk about the federal level in a moment. But even those are now being seemingly dismantled one by one, as they can do it, by the NRA and friends, as the Republicans' stolen and packed U.S. Supreme Court last week announced that they're going to hear this case this fall challenging New York's ban on carrying weapons outside of the home without a permit. Am I explaining that law and that case correctly?
Yeah, that's generally right. New York is one of 13 states, it might be 12, mm-hmm. between 12 and 13 states that have some kind of licensing system that requires individuals to obtain a license in order to have handguns. New York has a multi-layered system, which means that you could get different kinds of licenses for different kinds of activities. In order for you to, however, have an unrestricted license, you have to demonstrate probable cause for you to be able to obtain it. So you have to show that you're under some kind of serious threat for your safety, that threat exceeds the threat of the general population, and that's why you need that firearm. Now, it's a law that's been in place since 1911. It was strengthened in 1913, and so New York has had this on the books for just years and years and years now, mm-hmm. and it's worked. The state has some of the lowest gun deaths in the country, and the system allows individuals who can meet a certain requirement, who are really under threat, to obtain a firearm. But for years now, gun rights organizations have been trying to strike it down. And so this is the first time that the court accepted such a challenge. And of course, given, as you point out, the conservative majority on that court, there's a real probability that the New York licensing system could fall. And of course, the hope is that the ruling is narrow enough that licensing laws and other restrictions on firearms don't fall all over the country.
Yeah, well, if they're actually conservative, if they're actually contextualist, if they actually are originalist, who care about what the words of the Constitution actually say on this, I sure hope they notice those first four words, a well-regulated militia, when they judge this case, because this notion that you can't regulate because somehow that would violate the Second Amendment is absurd, but it's been one that the U.S. Supreme Court has been, it seems, in recent times, happy to go along with, thanks to the snow job that the NRA has done on this country. Lastly here, Igor, whether it's, you know, the NRA or the so-called gun movement in general, they still seem to have quite a bit of sway to prevent any actual gun safety legislation at the federal level from moving forward, no matter how many kindergartners get massacred in any given shooting. After this latest spate of mass shootings, President Biden has again called for reforms after taking a few executive actions on his own. Will those actions make any difference? And do you see any, and I mean any, pathway at this point towards any kind of reform at the federal level?
Well, the six administrative actions that the president has taken are really critical. And frankly, they will save thousands of lives. And this is everything from regulating ghost guns, which, as your audience probably knows, have become the favorite tools of white supremacists and extremists who are prohibited from owning guns otherwise. And so they have to get these unserialized gun parts and put them together at home and then go out and cause havoc. Mm-hmm. You know, the president also redirected federal funding for community-based violence intervention programs. These are incredibly important programs that have been able to reduce gun violence in communities by as much as 80%. And so his recognition and his commitment to that is so incredibly important. But you're right that Congress must do more, and frankly, the president must do more as well, because he's someone who ran on one of the most comprehensive gun violence prevention plans we've ever seen, right? He didn't just run on executive actions. And so I think what we expect of him and what we expect of Congress is to place the same kind of priority on this issue, as they did on COVID relief, as they're now placing on infrastructure, because this is no less a life or death issue for Americans than some of the other priorities. And so I think that what the president, what the Senate Majority Leader must do, and they must do this before the end of the year, frankly, is to find a viable path forward for these reforms in the Senate. And if that means getting rid of the filibuster so that we can finally pass a law or a bill that's supported by, as you point out, over 90% of Americans, including gun owners, with a simple majority, then so be it.
Well, even then, you know, and I hate to end every conversation and every interview with, Joe Manchin. That kind of seems where it comes down to.
Yeah, but you know, Brad, I gotta say, though, none of this stuff is static, right? If you create a viable pathway for moving a popular piece of legislation across the finish line with a simple majority, then there's an opportunity for two things to happen. One, for the president to pressure Joe Manchin on this issue. And two, for Joe's constituents back home in West Virginia to make sure that he hears from them about the importance they place in passing legislation that will help build safer communities. So my point on this is, yes, there are members of the president's own party who've raised skepticism either about the filibuster reform or about getting a robust background check bill across the finish line in the Senate. But what I'm saying is that in our democracy, there are levers we can pull to push those lawmakers along. And we've seen that succeed in the past. We can have it be successful on this issue as well.
If you would like to join Igor Volsky on that mission, and it is a worthy one and even an optimistic one, so it's a good time to get out, you can do so at his website, gunsdownamerica.org. You can follow them on the Twitters at gunsdownamerica, and you can follow him on the Twitters at Igor Volsky. He's the founder of Guns Down America, dedicated to building a future with fewer guns. And the new book is Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA. Well, you're almost there, Igor. And then the hard part, build a safer future with fewer guns. Igor Volsky, always great speaking with you, my friend. I look forward to doing it soon. We can come have, we can dance on the grave of the NRA once that actually happens. And it may not be long at this point.
Thank you, Brad. Always good being with you.
Thank you, sir. All right. Quick break. And, speaking of fraud, we got more of it ahead.
Oh, goody.
From the last guy and and his corrupt, fraudulent family. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Yeah, as NBC floated the idea of bringing Donald Trump back for The Apprentice.
I hope not.
I would not be surprised if it happened. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Donald Trump's adult children have cost taxpayers a whole lot of money over the years, but this time it is different, according to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CRU. The group, the Good Government Group, the nonprofit, nonpartisan good government group, you know, like what the NRA is supposed to be. Anyway, they have obtained records from the Secret Service that show that in just the 30 days after Trump left the presidency, his children's travel cost taxpayers more than $140,000. But that figure is really a low ball for several reasons. Most notably, it does not include charges at Trump properties in Bedminster, in Palm Beach, and Briarcliff, New York. Charges to the Secret Service paid to the Trump Organization itself, which would likely bring the actual total, not only of the cost to the taxpayer much higher, but also the totals that are actually going into Trump's own pockets. Because the other reason that these charges are different is that they all occurred after Joe Biden's inauguration. And ordinarily, a former president's children are no longer entitled to Secret Service protection after their father is out of office. Trump, however, took the unusual step of extending the protection for his family members and for three top appointees by 6 months.
Wow.
Giving them that much more time to funnel money into his own properties, to pay himself to protect his own children. With your money, by the way.
And they're billionaires.
And again,
supposedly.
Supposedly, right. And this all, with normal presidents, it stops the day that they leave office. But with the stroke of the pen, apparently, Trump is not only giving free protection to his children for 6 months that they are not entitled to, but much of that cost of doing so is going straight to him. What a grift. And we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars. And the thing is, the Secret Service did not, the crew had filed a Freedom of Information Act request in February to try to get an idea of these costs. They got a bunch of them. That's where they get this $140,000 number for the 1 month, for the month of February. But that does not include, apparently, any of the receipts from any of Trump's actual properties in,
around the world, yes.
Mar-a-Lago,
and we're talking, if it's 140 something thousand for 1 month and he's extended it for 6 months, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars into his pocket.
It's well over
taxpayer dollars.
Over millions of dollars, yeah.
Wow.
Apparently his kids travel everywhere all the time.
Of course they do.
And there's a list of you know, where Jared and Ivanka and Eric and Laura Trump and Don Jr. have gone, and to all of the various properties of Trump's that they have gone, and that is all money every time ka-ching straight into Donald Trump's pockets. The grift, it never ends. All right, we have to get out. Thank you very much to my producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Igor Volsky of GunsDownAmerica.org, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, or any other, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we try to do every day over your public airwaves. Thanks to your help. We are listener sponsored only. No grift here. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.